No man living in a community which such a religion as Christianity or Islam has touched can be altogether a slave. There is an ineradicable quality in these religions that compels men to judge their masters and to realize their own responsibility for the world. As men have felt their way towards this new state of mind, from the fierce self-centered greed and instinctive combativeness of the early Paleolithic family group, they've sought to express the drift of their thoughts and necessities very variously. They found themselves in disagreement and conflict with old established ideas, and there's been a natural tendency to contradict these ideas flatly, to fly over to the absolute contrary. Faced by a world in which rule and classes and order seem to do little but give opportunity for personal selfishness and unrighteous oppression, the first impatient movement was to declare for a universal equality and a practical anarchy. Faced by a world in which property seemed little more than a protection for selfishness and a method of enslavement, it was as natural to repudiate all property. Our history shows an increasing impulse to revolt against rulers and against ownership. We've traced it in the Middle Ages, burning the rich man's chateau and experimenting in theocracy and communism. In the French revolutions, this double revolt is clear and plain. In France, we find, side by side, inspired by the same spirit and as natural parts of the same revolutionary movement, men who, with their eyes on the ruler's taxes, declared that property should be inviolable, and others who, with their eyes on the employer's hard bargains, declared that property should be abolished. But what they're really revolting against in each case is that the ruler and the employer, instead of becoming servants of the community, still remain, like most of mankind, self-seeking, oppressive individuals. Throughout the ages, we find this belief growing in men's minds that there can be such a rearrangement of laws and powers as to give rule and order while still restraining the egotism of any ruler and of any ruling class that may be necessary, and such a definition of property as will give freedom without oppressive power. We begin to realize nowadays that these ends are only to be attained by a complex constructive effort. They arise through the conflict of new human needs against ignorance and old human nature. But throughout the 19th century, there was a persistent disposition to solve the problem by some simple formula, and be happy ever afterwards, regardless of the fact that all human life, all life, is throughout the ages nothing but the continuing solution of a continuous synthetic problem. The earlier half of the 19th century saw a number of experiments in the formation of trial human societies of a new kind. Among the most important historically were the experiments and ideas of Robert Owen, who lived from 1771 to 1858, a Manchester cotton spinner. He's very generally regarded as the founder of modern socialism. It was in connection with his work that the word socialism first arose, about 1835. He seems to have been a thoroughly competent businessman. He made a number of innovations in the cotton spinning industry and acquired a fair fortune at an early age. He was distressed by the waste of human possibilities among his workers, and he set himself to improve their condition and the relations of employer and employed. This he sought to do first at his Manchester factory and afterwards at New Lanark, where he found himself in practical control of works employing about 2,000 people. Between 1800 and 1828 he achieved very considerable things. He reduced the hours of labour, made his factory sanitary and agreeable, abolished the employment of very young children, improved the training of his workers, provided unemployment pay during a period of trade depression, established a system of schools, and made New Lanark a model of better industrialism, while at the same time sustaining its commercial prosperity. He wrote vigorously to defend the mass of mankind against the charges of intemperance and improvidence which were held to justify the economic inequities of the time. He held that men and women are largely the product of their educational environment, a thesis that needs no advocacy today. And he set himself to a propaganda of the views that New Lanark had justified. He attacked the selfish indolence of his fellow manufacturers, and in 1819, largely under his urgency, the first Factory Act was passed, the first attempt to restrain employers from taking the most stupid and intolerable advantages of their workers' poverty. Some of the restrictions of that act amaze us today. It seems incredible now that it should ever have been necessary to protect little children of 9 from work in factories, or to limit the nominal working day of such employees to 12 hours. People are perhaps too apt to write of the Industrial Revolution as though it led to the enslavement and overworking of poor children who had hitherto been happy and free. But this misinterprets history. From the very beginnings of civilization, the little children of the poor had always been obliged to do whatever work they could do. But the factory system gathered up all this infantile toil and made it systematic, conspicuous, and scandalous. The factory system challenged the quickening human conscience on that issue. The British Factory Act of 1819, weak and feeble though it seems to us, was the Magna Carta of childhood. Thereafter, the protection of the children of the poor, first from toil and then from bodily starvation and ignorance, began. We can't tell here in any detail the full story of Owen's life and thought. His work at New Lanark had been, he felt, only a trial upon a small working model. What could be done for one industrial community could be done, he held, for every industrial community in the country. He advocated a resettlement of the industrial population in townships on the New Lanark plan. For a time, he seems to have captured the imagination of the world. The Times and Morning Post supported his proposals. Among the visitors to New Lanark was the Grand Duke Nicholas, who succeeded Alexander I as Tsar. A fast friend was the Duke of Kent, son of George III and father of Queen Victoria. But all the haters of change, and all, and there are always many such, who were jealous of the poor, and all the employers who were likely to be troubled by his projects, were waiting for an excuse to counterattack him, and they found it, in the expression of his religious opinions, which were hostile to official Christianity, and through those he was successfully discredited. But he continued to develop his projects and experiments, of which the chief was a community at New Harmony in Indiana, United States of America, in which he sank most of his capital. His partners bought him out of the New Lanark business in 1828. Owen's experiments and suggestions ranged very widely and don't fall under any single formula. There was nothing doctrinaire about him. His New Lanark experiment was the first of a number of benevolent businesses in the world, Lord Leverhulme's Port Sunlight, the Cadbury's Bourneville, and the Ford businesses in America are contemporary instances. It was not really a socialist experiment at all. It was a paternal experiment. But his proposals for state settlements were what we should call state socialism today. His American experiment and his later writings point to a completer form of socialism, a much wider departure from the existing state of affairs. It's clear that the riddle of currency exercised Owen. He understood that we can no more hope for real economic justice while we pay for work with money of fluctuating value than we could hope for a punctual world if there was a continual inconstant variability in the length of an hour. One of his experiments was an attempt at a circulation of labor notes representing 1 hour, 5 hours, or 20 hours of work. the cooperative societies of today, societies of poor men which combine for the collective buying and distribution of commodities, or for collective manufacture, or dairying, or other forms of agriculture, arose directly out of his initiatives, though the pioneer cooperative societies of his own time ended in failure. Their successors have spread throughout the whole world, and number today some 30 or 40 million of adherents. A point to note about this early socialism of Owen's is that it wasn't at first at all democratic. Its initiative was benevolent, its early form patriarchal. It was something up to which the workers were to be educated by liberally disposed employers and leaders. The first socialism was not a workers' movement, it was a masters' movement.